Masquerade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
Tony Home Permanent presents...
This is Nora Drake.
And now your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. And with me once again is radio collector historian Ed Corcoran. How are you tonight, Ed?
Very good, Dick. It's nice to be here again with you.
Well, Ed, our show takes on a different format tonight. We have with us perhaps the greatest radio comedian of all time. In addition, we have the single most important radio newscaster of radio's golden age, whose nightly broadcast is heard by countless millions of Americans. And finally, we'll meet the woman behind the voice of radio's long-suffering heroine, Stella Dallas. What do you think of that lineup?
Gee, I'm really at a loss for words, Dick.
Well, I hope not. We won't have a show. Our first guest is a pioneer broadcaster, writer, and lecturer who has been delivering the news to America since 1930. I'm talking, of course, about Lowell Thomas. Ed, before we meet Lowell Thomas, let's hear once again a portion of his famous nightly newscast, this one dating back to 1945.
Sounds good, Dick.
Ladies and gentlemen, because of the importance of today's news, we present without delay the Sunoco News Voice of the Air, Lowell Thomas.
Good evening, everybody. Well, the Jap surrender was one of the fastest breaking of news stories, flashing through this morning with split-second transmission. In a radio station, a listening post in California, a United Press telegrapher was on the job, taking down radio stuff from Tokyo as usual. The Japs were putting out the usual kind of broadcast in English and in Morse code. The telegrapher was typing out that Morse code, but not on a typewriter. He was punching the keyboard of a teletype machine. And what he copied came out on the other end of the wire in the United Press newsroom at San Francisco. There, news editor Henan Hackett stood watching a message as it was ticked off on the machine. It was coming in slowly. The Japs were sending their Morse code at a dragging pace, about 25 words a minute. For an hour or so, Tokyo had been broadcasting humdrum news, something about the Jap Red Cross, for example. Then, here came another dispatch, as the news editor happened to be standing there looking. This one, like the others, began flat and dull, so it seemed. The slow-worded bulletin started in this tedious fashion. The Japanese government today addressed the following communication to the Swiss and Swedish governments. That made news editor Henan Hackett feel like yawning. It sounded like another Jap protest about the atomic bomb. Tokyo had been shooting out a routine of propaganda, complaining about the elemental devastation that had hit Hiroshima, and this sounded like an announcement of an official remonstrance through the Swiss and Swedish governments. The bulletin continued in that same slow gait, 25 words a minute. The Japanese government, it said in that dragging way, are ready to accept the terms of the joint declaration which was issued at Potsdam. And that brought a wild howl from one electrified news editor. There it was. Flash, he shouted to the teletype operators in the newsroom, the men who sit at machines connected with newspaper offices across this continent. They immediately started teletyping what he called out to them, the flash. The Japs offer to surrender, he said. And so on for the rest of the bulletin. The first news flashed to the American people of the Japanese acceptance of the Potsdam ultimatum. And that's how this greatest of stories broke. Ever since the news came in this morning of the Japanese surrender, I've been thinking about our fighting men scattered all over the globe. Having recently flown around the world, the picture is a vivid one to me. Our great air bases in North Africa, the Middle East, and Southern Asia, to say nothing of Europe, with hundreds of thousands of our boys tonight in Morocco, Tunis, Tripoli, Egypt, Arabia, Iraq, India, China, to mention only a few places. In all the history of man, there has never been anything like it, the way our Army and Navy people are deployed over most of this planet, over all of the continents and all of the seas. Even in the Arctic, all working with just one objective in view. And today, that job finished. Chenault Airmen in Kunming, our jungle specialists in Burma, the boys I found marooned at remote airstrips in tropical South America, our Arctic weather detachments in Baffin Land, Ellesmere Land, Greenland, the chaps I met at the Tibetan frontier who were buying up Central Asian horses for the Chinese armies, that cook who made us the delicious chocolate pie on a carrier off Okinawa, a carrier that a few days before had been hit by a suicide plane. They can all come home now.
Well, Lowell Thomas's style hasn't changed at all over the years, and people never seem to grow tired of him.
Yeah, they never do. That's right.
What a career this man has had. He was a war correspondent during the First World War and actually covered the exploits of Lawrence of Arabia. And he loves airplanes.
So we've had no one quite like this before.
That's for sure. In 1945, he described the final battle between the Germans and the Russians from a P-51 Mustang. After Europe, he set off on a round-the-world flight to assemble material on the Pacific theater of war. The information he collected was invaluable.
Yeah, I think it's still being used in some capacity today, Dick.
I'm sure it is. He was on board the first flight across the Antarctic from Africa to Australia in 1963 that took him from Cape Town to McMurdo Sound and then on to New Zealand. He's had a close association with flight all his life, it seems. He truly is a Renaissance man.
That's certainly the right word, Dick.
And when I interviewed him in 1969, he had just written a book with his son called Famous First Flights That Changed History. Let's listen to the interview.
Let's do that, Dick.
I'm speaking with a well-known commentator, Lowell Thomas, and we're going to discuss his new book, Famous First Flights That Changed History. 16 dramatic and historic adventures that opened aviation frontiers. Lowell, you took part in some of those flights yourself, as far as this book is concerned, didn't you?
I was lucky enough to be the historian of man's first circumnavigation of this planet by air.
What made you decide to write a book about aviation's history?
Well, the excuse for the book was that Lowell Jr., who is even more of an airman than I am, much, much more so, he lives in Alaska, does a great deal of glacier flying and rescue flying in the north, involved in politics, basically, and other things as well, but he happened to be the historian of man's first flight around this planet by way of both poles, which took place quite recently. And we all felt that that was the last of the important first long-distance flights that remained to be done. Oh, you could go on forever. There will be many, many other first flights from Hartford to Brazil and from New Haven to Ellesmere Land and so on. But I'm thinking about the first flight across the Atlantic, first flight across the South Atlantic, first flight across the Pacific, first flight over the North Pole, first over the South Pole, first halfway around the world, first around the world. And he was historian of the recent one, which was around the world by way of both poles. And it was such a smooth flight, and it was so lacking in adventure, in a sense, that there wasn't a great deal to tell. There's more to tell if you have a crash landing in the desert, or if you come down in the Persian Gulf, or if you come down in the North Atlantic, as some of the flyers did on our first flight around the world, or if you crash into a mountain. But it was so smooth, this last great flight around the world by way of both poles, that he decided there wasn't quite enough material for a full book. So why not tell the story of all the great first flights, or pick out those that we thought were entitled to this kind of recognition?
Well, if that was the last of the 16 great flights, what was the first?
Here again, you could get an argument, but I think that we were correct in what we did. You could say, well, wasn't the first long-distance flight the one that the Wright brothers made down at Kitty Hawk? Mm-hmm. That was only a few yards. They just flew a short distance. And the story of the Wright brothers' first flight has been told over and over and over again. So it seemed to us that the first long-distance flight, which wasn't very long, but then it seemed to be very long, was the one that the race to be the first to fly from the continent to the British Isles across the English Channel, only 22 miles. And Louis Blériot, of course, was the one who won that race back in 1909. The prize was offered by the London Daily Mail, and Blériot crashed 50 times before he had a plane that would get him across. That's number one.
Well, as a matter of fact, most of those early flights were races, weren't they?
Well, all of these that we write about virtually were races.
Even Lindbergh's flight then?
Oh, sure, that was a race, after all, very much so. And Lindbergh, of course, in a sense, is not entitled to be in this book, but we put him in anyhow because the effect of his flight was so tremendous on the world. It gave such terrific impetus to aviation. But Lindbergh was not the first to fly the Atlantic. He was the first to fly it solo. So we put him in anyhow.
As a matter of fact, he was preceded by over 70 people.
76.
And as you said, you took part in several of these flights. What was the most exciting on your own personal account?
Well, one of the flights in which I was involved was the first one that was ever made across the entire Antarctic. And that was only a few years ago also. I've forgotten what year now. It's 63, I think. So many things have happened, and I go from here to there all the time, so I forget. The first flight across the entire Antarctic was made by Navy airmen, and I went with them from Cape Town across the South Pole and on to Australasia. The man in command of that was Admiral Jim Reedy.
This is an exciting story, and I want to thank you very much for telling us about famous first flights that changed history. Our guest, Lowell Thomas.
Thank you, Dick. So long.
I love that. So long. That's his signature line. But you know, Ed, Lowell Thomas isn't always that serious. As a matter of fact, he is one of the easiest people to break up, and he usually manages to break himself up. I think this is one of the funniest breakups that you have in your collection, Ed. Are you ready?
Yeah, I think I can hardly wait.
The latest accomplishment of UNIVAC, telling a person what he ought to be reading. The electronic brain doing exactly that at the Seattle World's Fair. You fill out a card giving age, interests, background, and other personal information. The card is fed into the machine. Moments later, out comes the answer. For example, a 13-year-old boy said he'd like to know about rockets. He received a selective reading list. A 21-year-old girl said she was interested in sex. We'll skip that reply. UNIVAC almost had a spasm. One of the librarians in charge of the electronic brain is Marcia Holcomb of Denton, Texas. Her explanation... And so long until tomorrow.
This is Dick Noel reminding you to listen again Monday evening for Lowell Thomas and the News, brought to you by Oldsmobile.
This program came to you from the CBS News.
I think those unintended laughs are the most fun.
I like it.
Of course, when it comes to laughs, no one can beat Jack Benny. Now, Jack has always portrayed himself as being stingy and tight. In reality, he is extremely generous.
I might add that this guy is probably the most well-liked man in all radio.
You're so right. What many of us tend to forget is that this great comedian also plays the violin, which was the subject of an interview I did with him back in 1963. Before we get to that, however, let's play an excerpt from his Sunday night show featuring Jack and his violin teacher.
Okay, Dick.
Gee, when is the world going to recognize me for what I really am? A concert violinist.
Monsieur Benny, please. The violin lesson is over. Now may I have my money?
Professor LeBlanc, tell me something honestly. What do you think of my playing? Now, be frank.
You want the truth?
Yes.
First, give me the money for the lesson.
Look, I'm tired of being the comedian, the clown, the pagliacci.
Please, Monsieur Benny, I must go. Get the money out.
Sure, it's brought me fame and riches, but when you're not happy, what good is gold? It's turned to lead in my pocket.
Monsieur Benny, please, get the lead out.
If I could only be a concert.
Well, that interaction with Jack Benny's violin teacher was played strictly for laughs. But Jack is very serious about the violin and often gives concerts around the country with some of the finest symphony orchestras. And that's how I happened to meet him. I was permitted to sit in on his rehearsal with the Hartford Symphony Orchestra at the Bushnell Auditorium. And during one of his breaks, I interviewed him.
Jack, it's, you mind if I call you Jack?
No.
No, you can call me Jack.
I feel
I'm
as though
younger
I...
than you are.
I feel as though I know you, watching you on the CBS television network. Jack, we all know why you're here in Hartford. How long have you been doing these benefit performances?
These concerts?
Yes.
About 5 years.
Mm-hmm. All over the country?
All over the United States. I've done it with almost all the big cities, the major symphonies. The only two so far that I can think of that I haven't done Pittsburgh or Boston.
And might I ask you how long you've had this in the works? How long have you been planning for this particular concert?
Oh, for about 3.5 months.
Mm-hmm.
It was Isaac Stern who set this engagement for me. Yeah, in fact, I was in London at the time, and he was in Switzerland. And he called me from Switzerland, telling me about this this thing tonight.
Jack, this isn't the first time you've been to Hartford. If we might reminisce just a bit.
No, but then it's been so many years ago. It was in the days of Audible.
I see. This was before the radio show,
was it? Oh, sure. Sure, before this. I don't think I've been here in probably over 35 years.
Well, that's a long time.
Yeah.
Jack, can you tell us just a bit about what we have to look forward to tonight here at the Bushnell?
Well, it'll probably surprise a lot of people that I can play anything, you know? And I think they're going to get a lot of laughs and have a lot of fun at the concert. It's done for laughs, yet we try to play, you know, we try to make the music as legitimate as possible.
Well, I, having stood here in the wings for just a minute, was very much impressed with your ability to play.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm a frustrated violinist, you know, really.
Jack, thanks so much for taking time out to talk with us.
Well, that is a first, Dick.
Well, it certainly was for me. They just don't get any bigger than Jack Benny. How about another excerpt from his show, Ed?
Well, this particular excerpt, Dick, was hard to come by. I only have one complete show of this title in my whole collection, and it has Jack Benny. And so why don't we listen to it, and then maybe you comment on it, Dick, whether you remember this at all.
From Palm Springs, California, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and yours truly, Don Wilson. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, we're broadcasting from Palm Springs, California. This being such a romantic spot, I'd like to make the opening introduction with a little poem.
A poem?
Nestled in the hills, far away from care, is a place we go to breathe the desert air. And there, out by the pool, far from strife and toil, is our blue-eyed star selling suntan oil. And here he is, Jack Benny!
Thank you. Hello again, this is Jack Benny talking, and Don, since we're in a poetic mood, I've written a poem for you, too.
Oh, you have?
Yes. I did not like your jingle, and if one more joke you tell, it's Bon Voyage, Don Wilson, and Welcome Home, Von Zell. let's not have any more of your poems, eh, Henry Wadsworth, fat fellow? Well, anyway, it's sure good to get back to Palm Springs, isn't it, Don?
Yes, Jack. I always have a wonderful time here.
I do, too, particularly because a fella can have such privacy here. You know, Don, yesterday I passed a big crowd in front of the drugstore, and not one person turned around or even bothered to look at me.
Really? Well, Jack, why were there such a crowd gathered?
They were getting Eddie Cantor's autograph. Imagine.
But, Jack, if you say people here have so much privacy, why did they ask Eddie Cantor for his autograph?
They didn't ask him.
They didn't?
No. Don, when a man stops you on the street, sings two choruses of Ida, then stamps his name on your forehead, there's nothing you can do about it. What an eager. What an eager beaver.
Jack, you're just mad at Eddie because he beat you on the golf course yesterday.
Sure, but he wouldn't have beaten me if he'd have played fair.
Fair?
Yes, imagine this, Don. When we both got on the last green, just as I was getting ready to putt, he put down a dime to mark his ball.
What's wrong with that?
He divided my point of interest. Then when when I missed the putt, I got so mad I took a swing at the dime and sliced it right into my pocket. It's the first hole in one I ever made. Anyway, Don, I'm glad you mentioned golf because tonight our program is dedicated to the formal opening of the new Tamarisk Country Club here in Palm Springs. And it's really one of the most beautiful
golf... Hey, pardon me, but does this dull twosome mind if a funny man plays through?
Oh!
Hiya, folks.
Say, Phil, Don and I were just talking about Tamarisk, the beautiful new golf course. Since you're such a good golfer, Phil, you'll love it.
Yeah, I know, Jackson. I played in the tournament out there yesterday. It is. It's a great course.
I thought I saw you out there yesterday, Phil. You were playing with some of your musicians, weren't you?
No.
Well, I saw Remley, Sammy, and Fletcher going around the course with you.
Yeah, but they weren't playing. Remley was carrying my bag.
Well, what was Sammy doing?
He was carrying Remley.
Well, what was Fletcher doing?
He was carrying the stuff that made it necessary for Sammy to carry Remley.
Oh, yes, Remley is your handicap.
He ain't no water hazard.
I know.
Hey, Jackson, how about you and me playing out at Tamarisk someday?
Okay, Phil, maybe we can make a match.
Yeah, what do you usually go around then?
Well, my handicap is... Hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Hey, Don. Don, watch me. Watch me get him this time. Phil, ask me that again, will you?
Ask you what again?
What do you usually go around in?
Shorts or slacks, depending on the weather. Oh, Harris, Sammy may be carrying Remley, but you're carrying this program.
Phil, if that joke is carrying the program, I'd rather dragged a little bit. Anyway, I'll play golf with you anytime you want to.
Okay, Jackson, how much you want to bet?
I don't want to bet anything. All I want you to do is every time we get on the green, mark your ball with a dime.
A dime? Why?
I got a slice that'll make me a fortune. Oh, hello, Dennis.
Hello, Mr. Benny. Hello, everybody.
Well, Dennis, I hope you're having as much fun in Palm Springs as we are.
I sure am, but boy, am I tired.
Tired? What have you been doing?
Well, last night I went to the movies and I had to stand for 2 hours.
That crowded, huh?
No, there was plenty of room.
Then why'd you have to stand in the movies?
I went to a drive-in and I didn't have a car.
Now, wait a minute, Dennis. How did you get into a drive-in without a car?
Oh, I was carrying an umbrella and they thought I was a convertible.
Oh, stop being silly. What's that on your nose?
A windshield wiper.
What? Psst, psst, psst. Now cut that out! Windshield wiper. I suppose that thing on your forehead is your license number.
No, Eddie Cantor's autograph.
Oh, yeah. Now, Dennis, stop being silly and answer me. Are you having a good time?
Oh, I'll say. Friday night, I went to the Chi-Chi and saw Sally Rand. I never laughed so hard in all my life.
You know, Don, the weather here has been so beautiful today. I think
wait
I may...
Minute, wait a minute. Hold it. Let's go back here a minute. Look. didn't you listen to what this kid just said?
I listened to it, heard it, and ignored it.
Well, I ain't going to ignore it. Dennis, you went to the Chi-Chi and saw Sally Rand's act?
Uh-huh.
The Sally Rand?
Uh-huh.
And when you finally saw Sally Rand's act, you, laughed?
Yeah, I was sitting up so close, those fans tickled.
Don't look to me for sympathy, Bill. Years of experience have taught me that the only way to get along with Dennis have nothing more to do with him than is necessary. Like this, for instance. Now, Dennis, we're doing a program and you have to do a song.
Yes, sir.
What song are you going to sing?
The date boats are coming.
You mean shrimp boats.
This is Palm Springs, bud.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead and sing.
At all.
was Mistake, sung by Dennis Day and accompanied by Phil Harris and his Stumbling Tumbleweed Orchestra. And now, folks...
Hold it, Melvin. Just a minute. Just slow up a minute.
Huh?
I mean, look, I don't mind so much when we're at home, but when we're out of town, let's don't be making insulting remarks about the orchestra, huh?
Well, Phil, I got a right to make comments about your band. After all, who's the star of this show?
Well, when I see my paycheck, I know it ain't me.
Oh, stop complaining.
I'm not complaining, Jackson. It's just that I'd like to pay income tax like everybody else.
What?
They don't even think I'm a citizen.
Phil, the only reason people don't think you're a citizen is because with that bottle of Lord Calvert in your hand all the time, you look like an Englishman. Such a long line for such a little laugh. So don't argue with me about money, salary, or... Come in.
Hello, Mr. Benny.
Well, Mr. Gibson. Mr. Kitzel, it's certainly nice seeing you. What are you doing here in Palm Springs?
Oh, I just came down for a little visit.
Oh, good. Where are you living?
At the Hacienda Paseo de la Sal.
The Hacienda Paseo de la Sal?
Sal is my brother-in-law.
Oh, he's married to your sister?
Yeah, her name is Hacienda.
Well, what about Paseo?
He's a silent partner.
Oh, I see. Well, tell me, Mr. Kitzel, is your wife is here with you?
Yes, and are we having fun? We go swimming, we play tennis, and you know this morning my wife rented a bicycle built for two.
Oh, and you both went for a ride, huh?
No, just her.
Then why did she get a bicycle built for two?
Believe me, she can use it. Well, goodbye, Mr. Benny.
So long, Mr. Kitzel. Thanks for dropping in. Well, it seems that everybody's in Palm Springs this week.
You know, Jack, I'm glad I'm here, too, because I did some research on this community that I'm sure will please our sponsor very much. Now, who were the earliest Americans in America?
Why, the Indians, of course.
That's right. Now, here around Palm Springs, there are many Indians. So, yesterday I went out in the desert till I met some members of the tribe that first settled Palm Springs, the Coahuila Indians.
The Coahuilas?
Yes, and do you know what those Indians said to me?
No, Don, what? Oh, for heaven's sake. What else? It was the Tokwitz Indians who founded Palm Springs, not the Coahuilas.
Oh, no, you're wrong, Jack. It was the Coahuilas.
I'm not wrong, Don. I'll prove that I'm right. There happen to be quite a few Indians in the audience, so I'll ask one of them. I'll ask that one in the front row. He must be a chief. He's wearing a headdress. Excuse me, but was it the Tokwitz Indians or the Coahuilas who founded Palm Springs?
I don't know.
Well, what tribe do you belong to?
I don't know.
Well, where's your reservation?
I don't know.
You don't know anything. You're a fine Indian.
I'm not an Indian.
Then how come you're wearing those feathers in your hair?
I went to the Chichi last night and sat too close.
Well, then, Smarty, if you went there last night, you must be an Indian because I know you had a reservation. Hey, that was pretty funny, wasn't it, Dennis?
I don't know.
Look, Dennis, why don't you just... I'll get it. Hello?
I have a long-distance call for Jack Benny.
This is Jack Benny.
It's Collect. Hello? Hello?
I'm here. A Collect call, huh? Operator, find out who's calling.
Just a moment. Mr. Benny will not accept the charges till he knows who's calling.
Tell him it's Lana Turner.
Rochester! Rochester, Rochester. I thought you'd be down here by now. Where are you calling from?
From Pomona.
Pomona? What'd you stop there for?
I got a flat tire.
Oh, that's too bad.
No, that's good. It was laying in the road, and it's better than the one we had on.
Oh.
If I find three more, I'll be there by morning.
Well, you better be here by morning. I'm going to play golf, and I want you to caddy for me.
Oh, boss, I hate to caddy for you at Palm Springs.
Now stop complaining. Tamarisk is a very level course. There's nothing tough about it.
Nothing for you, but how about me? I have to carry a golf bag, 12 clubs, a basket of sandwiches, a gallon of lemonade, a first aid kit, and a parasol.
So what?
You don't need a caddy, you need a burro.
Oh, Rochester, you don't carry so much.
I don't. Remember what happened last time I went out loaded down like that?
What happened?
An old prospector tied a rope around my neck and led me off into the mountains.
Why'd you go with him?
I couldn't see where I was until he unloaded me.
Well, stop making things up. Anyway, I'm going to play golf in the morning, and I want you to caddy.
Okay, I'll do it, but do me a favor this time, will you?
What is it?
If we lose a ball, let's forget it. Those bloodhounds are hard to handle.
Okay, goodbye.
Goodbye. Oh, say, boss.
Now what?
Aren't you doing another television show next Sunday, March 9th, on CBS Network at 4:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time?
That's right. Why?
You're paying for this call. Let's put a commercial in it.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Rochester. Goodbye.
Bye.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, in honor of the opening of Palm Springs' newest golf course, Tamarisk, we are going
Jack, before we go any further, I must tell you something, and I know you're going to be surprised.
Surprise? What is it, Don?
There's a friend of yours who also belongs to Tamarisk, and he'd like to come on and say a few words.
A friend of mine? Well, who is it?
Danny Kaye. Come on in, Danny!
Danny Kaye! Well, hello.
Hello, Danny.
Hello, Jack Benny.
But, Danny, this is such a surprise coming right out on my program. It's...
Oh, stop stuttering. I'm not going to charge you for it.
Oh.
Now, Jack, the reason I'm here is... Well, because every time you come to Palm Springs, you always do an informal show. Isn't that right?
That's right.
Well, some of the boys at the club cooked up an idea that I'm sure you're going to like.
What is it?
Well, we decided to form a quartet and sing the song you wrote.
My song?
Mm-hmm.
When you say I beg your pardon, then I'll come back to you.
Suddenly I'm sick.
What?
Oh, anyway, Jack, the other three fellas are out outside. Can I call them in?
Three fellas? Who are they?
Yeah, well, Frank Sinatra, George Burns, and Groucho Marx.
George, Frankie, and Groucho. Hello, fellas.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, that's brilliant dialogue.
Well, welcome to the show, fellas, and if you say the magic word, you get a bottle of suntan oil.
Say, Jack, that reminds me.
Huh?
Jack?
What?
That reminds me.
Huh?
That bottle of suntan oil you sold me was much too greasy, and boy, was I embarrassed.
Why? What happened?
Well, yesterday when I put some on, I slipped right out of my suit.
No kidding.
Look, fellas, I came here to sing, so let's do it and get it over with, okay?
Okay.
When I say I beg your pardon.
Hold it, hold
it. Yes, not yet.
When I say...
Aye. Groucho, that's me.
I may sing lousy, but I'm grammatically correct.
I'm sorry.
I'm Groucho.
Now, look, fellas.
Fellas, come on. I'll sing Jack's song.
And, fellas, I want to tell you how much I appreciate your coming over to do it. No one but real friends, real pals, would give up a Sunday afternoon just to come over here and do this wonderful
Jack,
song. What?
Shut up.
All right, fellas, let's take it.
Now, what key we're going to sing it in, Danny?
It'll help if we all take different ones.
Look, boy.
All right, fellas, let's go. Can we have a nice introduction, please? Oh.
say I beg your pardon,
then I'll come back to you.
When you ask me to forgive you, I'll return.
Like the swallows at Serrano, return to Capistrano. For you, my heart will always, always yearn.
Will always yearn. So, my darling, though we've parted, come back to whence we've started.
And, sweetheart, I'll come back to. Sweetheart, I'll come back to. Sweetheart, I'll come back. Gentlemen, I want to thank Danny Kaye, George Burns, Frank Sinatra, Groucho Marx, and Benny Rubin for appearing on my program today. We'll be back with you next Sunday on radio at the same time and on television a half hour later, when I hope you will all be watching. Excuse me. Hello?
Hello, is this Jack Benny?
Yeah.
Is this the Jack Benny that was born in Racine, Wisconsin?
No, I was born in Waukegan, Illinois.
Well, you got a sister named Jeanette, haven't you?
No. My sister's name is Florence.
Well, are you the Jack Benny that drives a light green DeSoto?
No. I have a Maxwell.
But you play the piano, don't you?
No, I'm sorry. I play the violin.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Jack, who was that?
A phone call from a stranger. Good night, Paul.
Yes, it's just great hearing Jack Benny because he is as fresh today as ever. You know, Ed, recently you had the opportunity to interview one of the great radio actresses of the Golden Age.
Yes, Dick. This woman holds the record for being on the air in afternoon serial, as they used to call them. So that ought to give a clue right there who it might be.
You've got to be talking about Ann Elsner, who played the part of Stella Dallas on NBC for some 18 years. Before we meet her, do you think we might listen to a little of the original program?
Yeah, this is a very rare show, but I do have a copy.
Here then, from 1945, is an excerpt from that long-running and long-suffering soap opera produced by Frank and Ann Hummert, Stella Dallas.
And now, Stella Dallas. Can Stella's unusual and dangerous plan to help her friends, Neil and Christine Rayburn, succeed?
Oh, how lucky we were, Phil Baxter and me, that little Teddy Rayburn came clear across town to my place at the Rumen House. And he did talk about his stepmother, Harriet Rayburn. And the dictaphone took down every word he said.
Right now, Harriet Rayburn, who is Neil's sister-in-law, is knocking on a door in the impressive Rayburn home.
Christine? Let me in. Christine, will you open that door at once? Christine, I want my child. Unlock that door and let me in. Teddy? Teddy? Oh, really, this is insufferable. Christine, how dare you take my son in that room and lock the door? You just wait until your husband hears about this. He'll leave you forever. Oh, Christine, will you open that door?
Hello, Harriet. What's the trouble?
Stella? Well, what are you doing here? Trying to interfere again?
Phil Baxter and me just came over.
I know what happened. You put Teddy up to slipping out of this house and crossing town alone to that rooming house where you live.
Take it easy, please. First of all, that ain't true. Teddy came across town of his own accord. He came because he heard you quarreling with Christine. He heard you say you'd kill her.
Well, of all the fantastic
Harriet
talk.
Rayburn, you didn't even know that child was away from home until Christine brought him back.
That's not true.
Oh, yes, it is.
Stella, I'm perfectly well aware of every deceitful thing you've done. I even know that Neil went to see you at the rooming house. And I suppose he came in with you and Mr. Baxter.
You're supposing wrong. And I'm mighty glad to find out that Neil hasn't been home since he talked to me.
I don't know what you mean by that.
I kind of think you do, Harriet.
Neil and Christine haven't been getting along very well. It's only natural for Neil to stay away from home.
Why, that's about the meanest thing I've ever heard anybody say. There ain't a doubt in my mind that you've done everything you can to ruin their happiness and their trust in each other and even their marriage itself.
Stella, you'd better watch what you say. I'll be forced to repeat every word of this to Neil.
Oh, I'm sure you will repeat it. But you may have a big surprise in store for you.
Oh, don't think you can turn Neil against me.
Harriet, I've got a hunch you yourself will turn him against you.
Well, don't you think you're being rather absurd? Neil has made it very plain that he likes and respects me.
Oh, Stella, dear.
Yes, Phil?
Could you come downstairs?
Well, I'll be right down, Phil. And, Harriet, if I were you, I'd stop pounding on Christine's door.
This chapter in the later life of Stella Dallas is written by Anne Hummert and is based on the famous character created by Olive Higgins Prouty in her great novel. Stella Dallas will be on the air at the same time tomorrow, that is Monday, at 4:15 p.m. Eastern Wartime. This is Frank Gallup speaking. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
That brings back memories even for me. Well, Ann Elsner, who played Stella Dallas, was a guest at the annual convention of the Society of American Vintage Radio Enthusiasts in New Haven recently. And Ed, you had a chance to interview her. What I want to know is how she managed to make the character of Stella Dallas so convincing and so natural.
I find, for instance, in rehearsals, in acting, in radio, I never liked, they sent me the script every day, I mean, it was sent, but I never opened it until we got there, because I felt that if we would go, when we did go into the studio, we sat at a table and went through it and timed it. Then we got to the mic and we went over it again. And if there were any things that we did have to make short or cut, then we did it, and may go do a scene or two. But I feel, just as now I'm talking to you, you have to grope for words. You do it in conversation, I just did it then. But if you know it so glibly and read it, it's difficult enough to read a script and be realistic. I mean, it's an art all its own that people don't realize, especially even after you've been in the theater, which I had been in, you see, in the theater, it's a different technique entirely. So all you have is your voice. So I always felt that it was very bad to over-rehearse.
Well, some scripts you would paraphrase. I'm not sure the Hummets would allow this, but they would give you a sentence, but you would kind of say it your own way. You might slur a word here or there, or you might change the wording, but not the meaning of the sentence. But they didn't allow you to do that, did they, on the Hummert shows?
At times, they did, because I lived Stella, and I knew, and there were certain things that would come up I knew Stella couldn't say. I couldn't say it, because I knew Stella wouldn't say it. But I always would respect a director. And at one time, they gave us a notice that they didn't want any changes. And one day I was in, we had went into rehearsal, and I had a line, and I just automatically changed it. And when we got through, the director said, you can't change that line. I said, well, why not? He said, well, they've told us now, they don't want any changes. And I said, well, Stella would not say that to Minnie Grady. I couldn't possibly say it. And he insisted. And because he had gotten this word, so I, being a trooper, I did it the way he said. And when I got home, my little maid I was talking about today met me, and she said, "Oh, Miss Matthews, how could you say, said the line to Minnie Grady?"
I looked at the Golden Age book, and there must have been 100 different actors on the show. Is that your about your count, or how many came and went over the 18 years?
Oh, I would think that. This was everybody in radio, I think, at some time. And you're just saying that I would like to say, in case you people have just tuned in, I would like to say, this is Stella Dallas. Remember me and my lolly baby?
I know over the period of time, many, many plots came and went. Do you recall any that you thought were really way out as far as this predicament you got yourself into during the series?
There was one that where I was, they had captured me, and I was in a submarine in the Suez Canal.
Fantastic.
Funnily enough, at that time, in the papers, something all about the Suez Canal. Later, there was a terrific train wreck in the papers. And lo and behold, in a few days, a day or two, we had it on the script, because that had been written ages before. And Stella, oh my goodness, I dragged the bodies out, and I was the savior of all of these people. Dead bodies and people to pull out of the windows. Oh, I must have been an Amazon, really. But we got most of them out.
I understand your husband was in the restaurant business for many years, and so were you.
He was from Maryland, and I was born in Louisiana. And he... when we married, we were here. First I was in Sunup, and he would come up to see me, and he just couldn't stand. He would sit backstage, and this love scene, that would get him. The man would kiss me and love me, you know, and he kept saying, "I wish you'd get out of this."
Yeah.
I didn't like it at all. So this is something I don't think I've ever told anybody. But finally, we did a... broadcast for the English, an English company of Sunup, and we were all set to go to England in it. And we were going to be presented to the Queen and the King. And he wrote me, and I told him I could go, I was going, or could I go, sort of. And instead of his saying no, which would have been just fine because I would have gone, he said, "Well, yes, you do what you want, but I couldn't put that ocean between us." So, of course, I didn't go.
Well, I guess during this 18-year run, you felt, as many people felt during that time, that it's going to go on forever, that these characters are so much a part of America that you just couldn't extinguish them. You know, it was part of our life, but it did happen. And the soaps did go, and it affected you very, very strongly emotionally, didn't it?
It just felt like part of me was dead. But it was a great help that I was in the restaurant business. I was really on stage all the time. They'd come in and ask me to say "Lolly Baby," and people would say, "Oh, my grandmother used to listen to you." And I had one day, one of the waitresses came up and said, "Miss Matthews, this lady," she told me where she was. And I looked back, and here she was, this old, beautiful woman, all in black, white hair. And I went back, and she said, "You know, I wanted to meet you because my husband loved you so, and you meant so much to him." He was a very famous, at the time, I've forgotten it now, but I knew the name, because he was a big surgeon in Philadelphia. And she said every day when he came, got through, he would come in his car, and he would listen to your show. And many a day I looked out at the curb, and if it wasn't over, he sat there and listened to it.
What's Stella Dallas doing today?
Well, it's like being asked to come here and to meet all my friends, and in many places where they do want me to come and talk to them. And I get fan letters, and I've had so many interviews just this past 2 weeks A man called me from Washington. He was with the Los Angeles Times. And he said he'd like to interview me.
I'm sure our audience is happy to know that Stella Dallas is alive and well, and who knows, maybe some of these days they might even bring the show back. You know, anything is possible, and if they do, only one person can play the role, right, Ann?
God bless you all.
Well, that was a great interview, Ed. You know, this has been a lot of fun.
Well, we have to do this more often, Dick.
Yes, I think
I like
so.
It. I like it.
Well, that about wraps it up for tonight. It was really great hearing the voices of all these stars again. Such wonderful memories. Now, until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio with Dick Bertel was produced and edited by Bob Schirago. This is Bill Hansen speaking.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day.